Thank you all for joining us for a very special episode of Sop Rep Radio. 3 years ago, Brandon Webb and myself, Ian Scotto, we had the privilege of touring the 9/11 Memorial Museum with Tim Brown, who you're going to hear from, who was there on 9/11, firefighter, experienced the tragedy, lost guys, and you'll hear him go in depth about what this day means to him. As I'm editing this show again and putting all this in, man, it really was a powerful experience, and I think this was a powerful episode. So if you never got a chance to hear what was originally episode 162, what better time than now as we reflect on what happened on this day, which ironically was also on a Tuesday, 17 years ago. You'll hear me talk about what I experienced, Brandon, guys that I've lost, and in the war on terror, guys that Brandon lost. So interesting perspective from everybody, and no matter what you experienced on that day, if you're someone who fought in the war on terror, or if you lost guys in the tower on any of those planes, this is in dedication and memorial to them. So we hope that you enjoy it. Let's get into it. SofRep.com, on time, on target. Brandon Webb actually invited me out with him to the 9/11 Memorial Museum. He had a friend named Tim Brown who actually survived 9/11, retired New York City firefighter, and we're on our way there. And Tim, thank you so much for doing this for Brandon and letting me tag along.
Sure.
If you want to get in some background of your story, I know it's, you know, very intriguing, and 9/11 is an event that affected all of us, of course.
Yeah, in 2001, I was in the mayor's office of emergency management working for Mayor Giuliani. So our office was actually 7 World Trade Center. So I was there when the first plane slammed into the North Tower. So, you know, I did my thing, my assignment. I was in the lobby of Tower 1. I saw my best friend, Terry Hatton, who was a captain of Rescue 1. And he gave me a big hug and kissed me on the cheek and said, "I love you, brother. I may never see you again." And he and his men went in the stairwell. Like so many other firemen, 343 New York City firemen, 93 of them were my friends who were murdered by radical Islamists that day. 37 Port Authority police officers, heroes, and 23 New York City police officers all stepped forward, as everyone in the military does, volunteered and said, "I will lay down my life for people I don't know, for my neighbor." One of the greatest things that we could do. So when I talk to kids and when I talk to, you know, colleges and things, I say that your firemen, police officers, and military become heroes the day they raise their hand and say, "I will give my life for that of another." And so they were heroes long before September 11th, just as our military heroes were that the day that they joined the military and
Absolutely.
Said, "I will do it."
Yeah, I was going to say, we'll get into it more with Brandon, I'm sure, but 9/11 is just an event that impacted every single thing and where we went from there in our foreign policy, what this country has defended. So, you know, even just everyday life for civilians, I can remember a time when you could walk into an arena, a baseball game, and no one patted you down. And I'm sure kids who grew up in that post-9/11 world who are probably 5 or 10 years younger than me don't even remember that. And it's just... it's changed every aspect of our lives.
Yeah, I mean, this is a different world now. And, you know, one of my greatest worries is that we are not saying what it is. You know, we're trying to bury the truth of who did it to us. We're trying to bury the truth that we are at war. If everybody thinks back who was around that day, when the second plane hit the South Tower, everybody in this country, in fact, around the world, had the same thought: America is at war. And we're in denial of that, and that's puts us in great danger, especially here in New York City. Mm-hmm. We've been very lucky, but a lot of that has been because of the work of the New York City Police Department and our intelligence community in identifying and saying what it is. And we are at war with radical Islam. And, you know, we've got to get the good folks on our side, Dr. Zudi Jasser and his group out of Phoenix. He's a U.S. Navy captain who is a Muslim, and he's an American patriot. He's a secular Muslim. He believes that we can live side by side in different religions and coexist, truly coexist.
Yeah, and I think we always talk about that at the site. I mean, Jack Murphy, who's an Army Ranger, editor-in-chief of the website, and I'm sure Brandon as well, but I just know from Jack's experience, has served with Muslims who he'll say have done more to fight radical Islam more than most of the people in this country, of course, myself included, who hasn't served.
I totally agree with that. You know, the people who are the victims most frequently of radical Islam is Muslims.
For sure.
All over the world. And, you know, I just read an article that Muslims are fleeing European countries to come to this to the United States because this is the last place on earth they feel safe. And I've talked with many of them who are my friends, women who don't want to live under Sharia law. They want to live in freedom and equality. And they come here and they're scared that this is the last place on earth where they can have freedom, the last country in the world where they can have freedom.
I have to ask one last question before we get to the museum that I was just wondering as a firefighter. The firefighters, as you know, you being a firefighter, the firefighters have always been split on basically how Giuliani acted during 9/11, if, you know, the idea that their communications were not up to par with where they should have been. I mean, do you have a feeling on that whole issue?
I am intimately familiar with the radio issue. It was not a Rudy Giuliani problem. In fact, today, it's a technology problem. Today, we still have the same problem 13, 14 years later. You cannot have, there's no radio system in the world where you can have 100 firemen trying to talk at the same time. You just can't do it. The technology is not there to figure out how to do it. And the unions, the National Union, the International Association of Firefighters, is a very left-leaning union, and they had a political agenda to attack Rudy Giuliani. If you ask firemen who worked under Giuliani, they will say what a great job he did cleaning up this city, what a great job he did supporting the fire department. And that's it. I mean, he's an American hero.
Got you. Yeah, not to get political there, but I just figured it was something to ask because it has been a controversial topic for people when they look at firefighters in 9/11. But we're on our way to the museum, so I'm sure we'll get some great audio there. You wanted to bring one last thing?
Yeah, I just want to talk about Brandon and I. Brandon and I were introduced by a good friend, a mutual friend, Maria Emma, who's in the entrepreneur organization with Brandon. And we have started to form this group of awesome people here in New York. One of my, you know, my heroes, besides the guys who gave their lives, are the guys that went overseas, the U.S. military. Of course, especially the Navy SEALs and the special operators. So I am honored to be in this car taking American heroes to the museum. I hope that with Brandon we can do that more, and I invite the military community to come to the museum. It is incredibly powerful and well done. And please come, please look up Brandon or me, and we'll let them know you're coming and come see the great job they did.
See, that's the part of the original tower. It's shaped like a trident. And we have one of those steel towers at the Dev Group compound in Virginia Beach.
Did you know it was in the entrance like that, or you just kind of saw it as you walked in?
I just saw it right now.
Very cool.
I've seen it at the Dev Group compound.
All right, so I'm walking through the museum with Brandon. They're playing the newscast basically the day that plane hit, and I was wondering actually where were you when the planes hit the towers?
I just come back from a workout in the morning, and I walked in to my house, and I remember seeing the second plane hit the tower. And
what state were you in actually?
I was at SEAL Team 3 in Coronado, California, and so the situation I was in was that my SEAL platoon was the next platoon to rotate overseas. So I knew as soon as that plane hit that I was going to be on a plane somewhere, and it was going to happen within a few days, if not hours. And I looked, at the time I was married, and I looked over and my wife at the time was 8.5 months pregnant, so I knew I was going to miss the birth of my son, didn't know whether I was going to come back. So, you know, the gravity of it, I'm walking through this museum, I still get chills that run down my spine. So it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
The amount of work that went into this and how it, I think, affects most everybody. The only other museum I've been to that even comes close is Warsaw Uprising in Poland, which is an incredible museum. I encourage anyone to go visit that as well. But this is unbelievable. I can't believe I haven't been here sooner.
Yeah, I was going to say, obviously we all felt anger and sadness, and you felt that on a gravitated scale. But was part of you thinking, you know, this is what I joined the SEALs for, and I'm going to go do the duty that I signed up to do?
Without a doubt, there was. I think that really polarized the free world to go, you know what, this is unacceptable. And it's in the same way I think the world is coming together today based on the attacks, ISIS, you know, like the Japanese journalists. Everyone's coming together, banding together, going, this is unacceptable, and we're going to go take it to these bastards. And that was the sentiment for sure. There was 100% clear that I was going to go overseas and get some payback and help out, stomp out the radical terror camps that were in Afghanistan, and knowing full well that I could never come back. And I was like, I would have got on the next plane overseas. Like, I was just that committed to giving my life to this country and the support of freedom. And that's why I get so pissed off when I look at, you know, the laws that our own government passed around the Patriot Act that really degrade our civil liberties in this country, because that's what America is about, freedom. It's not about being scared and sacrificing our freedoms for laws that are very restrictive and invade our privacy. Like, that shouldn't be the direction we went. And unfortunately, a lot of politicians, and both presidents, Obama and Bush, made laws that really, people right in the open, they disguise them under very patriotic names.
Yeah.
And in reality, they're very unpatriotic legislation that was passed. And coming back from war in Afghanistan and Iraq and getting out of the military and seeing it from a different lens, it really infuriates me. And that's why, you know, Jack Murphy, the other writers on the site, myself, like, we care so much about this country. And we write the things we do because we care. And so that's what I think makes SoftRep.com such an amazing site, is the perspective that we have, and that we're not afraid to... We don't need our fucking White House press pass. We don't need the fucking public affairs officer to get access. Like, we're getting real stories and real perspective from real American heroes.
Yeah, the first artifact we're looking at here is the steel from the north face of the North Tower, which was Tower 1. That was the tower that was hit first. And the National Institute of Standards and Technology identified this steel as the first impact steel that the first plane hit. So you can see the way it's bent around here, and you can see that it did some damage to the steel, but it actually ripped the plane apart more than the steel. So we're sitting at the wall with 2,976 tiles, blue tiles, and it's an art installation that is supposed to represent the opinion of each person who was murdered that day, their opinion of what the sky looked like. So every shade of blue here is different. You have the quote here, "No day shall erase you from the memory of time," by Virgil. And behind this wall is the remains of the unidentified victims that have not been identified yet through DNA. So it's an area that's off limits to the public. It is only for the families. It's run by the New York City Medical Examiner's Office, so that families who never got an identified piece of their loved one back can come here and reflect. That number is about 1,100 out of the nearly 3,000 who were murdered. So it's a lot of families who come here to visit their loved one. To the left here, you'll see we're underneath the actual waterfall, which is the footprint of the North Tower. And to our right is the same thing, the footprint of the South Tower. So we're kind of sitting in between the two actual footprints of the Twin Towers. under the South Tower is the room in memoriam, which is dedicated to each victim. There's a photograph of each victim and stories in media about each victim. Next to that is a film called Rebirth at Ground Zero, which is a film that I participated in. It's a 12-minute short film about the physical rebirth of Ground Zero through time-lapse photography, and then our audio over it, so some quotes and things that we talked about over the 9-year project of Project Rebirth. Then back over to the left underneath the North Tower is the historical exhibit, which is loaded with artifacts. It could take you up to 4 hours to get through it if you stop and look at everything in there. It's massive. Also over there is the last column, the Fire Truck Ladder 3, which my very good friend, best friend, Patty Brown, was the captain of, and other artifacts and stuff. So if you're going to come here, you could run through in 2 hours, but if you take your time going through, it's probably, most people take about 3 hours to get through it, and people that are more particular might take 4 hours, but by then it's, you know, you need to come back another time. So
what's the must-see thing here? Like, if you were going to come and you had your family and you only had a couple hours, like, what would you, what are, like, the top three things that you would...
Right, I would recommend the room in memoriam, for sure. Everybody should go there and pay their respects to the victims of Islamic terrorism. And then probably going through the historical exhibit, because it's there's just so much important stuff in there. The film Rebirth at Ground Zero is developing a reputation as kind of the uplifting exhibit here, because it shows the actual rebirth and how America comes back, and the towers and the buildings are rebuilt, and our lives find new happiness and love and joy again. So, you know, as hard as it was for us, we did find new happiness in our lives.
Nothing more than sharing what he had with other people. That was very important to him. He was a big Mets fan. He had season tickets to the Mets. He would have an extra ticket, and he loved nothing more than to look for a young child that was looking for a ticket and to hand the ticket and see, say, here, this is for you. And that would be like his real joy, to see the kid and sit there and see how good the seats were and enjoy the game. And he would enjoy the game with them. You know, buy hot dogs and buy, you know, whatever they wanted.
Of course, every New York City Frontman knew who Patrick Brown was. Patty Brown, as we call him. He was just a famous guy in the New York City Fire Department. He was the most unselfish, humble hero that I've ever met. He would leave most of his medals in his drawer because he didn't want to make any other firemen feel bad. He taught me respect for the uniform. What it means to be a New York City fireman and do what we do, and then put your hands in your pocket, letting it be enough to know that you did the work that we did and you didn't talk about it. He helped me improve my humility. Patty Brown died living the life the way he lived his life, being a leader, being the bravest of the brave, the most heroic of the heroes, and American patriot.
All right, so we're standing in front of the fire truck of a man that you know very well.
Yeah.
And if you want to get into it for our listeners and tell us about him, I recorded some of the audio in there. But
yeah, Patty Brown was one of my two best friends. He was a captain of Ladder 3 in Manhattan and a legend in the New York City Fire Department. He was one of the highest decorated firemen ever in the New York City Fire Department. He was, so he took his men in. They were climbing up the stairs. They were saving people's lives. The last audio recording we have of Patty Brown is he dialed the fire department dispatcher on a hard line, and he was describing the conditions and the lives that they were saving. His last words were, this is 3 truck and we're still headed up. And that was so true and representative of all the firemen that day. We found Patty Brown's backup helmet in the trunk of his car at the firehouse, and that helmet is now donated back to the museum and is on display
Yeah, we're looking at it right now.
We're looking at it right now, and it's in front of his ladder three, which was very badly damaged. Ironically, this ladder truck and our other best friend, Terry Hatton's rescue truck, were parked right next to him, next to each other, and they were crushed kind of together. It was just very representative of what happened that day.
I mean, I'm watching the video and just wondering what it's like.
Yeah, this is
for the surviving firemen. I mean, these guys that just lost some of their closest friends, but they're still having to like work and deal with all the tragedy of it.
We're in shock, really. Yeah. I mean, we know we have a job to do. Yeah. You know, when this video is shot, we still think there's a chance that we would find someone alive, which turned out not to be true. There were very, very few guys found alive in the rubble. But, you know, we're used to, the New York City firemen and the New York City police officers are used to being the ones who can solve any problem and fix any situation. And on September 11, 2001, we were unable to do that. We were fish out of water. And I remember being under the rubble of the Marriott Hotel thinking, Where is our military? We need them because it was over our heads. We needed the fighter jets over our head, and we needed our badasses to come and protect us because we were under attack and we couldn't fight back. We couldn't defend ourselves. The image that always reminds me, or I think is the image that is most representative of how I feel, is a pencil drawing done by a Pennsylvania school teacher of a New York City fireman coming out of the rubble of the World Trade Center with an American flag, handing it to a U.S. Military person, and the military person says, "I'll take it from here." And that's really what happened that day. And our military, our special operators, took it to the enemy on our behalf in the memory of my friends.
Absolutely. And then that's where you came in.
Well, we had, I don't know where they showed up, but we had, within day, like, I don't want to say, like, the next day, we had a box full of, like, New York City fire patches, and, like, we took those overseas and slapped them on our uniforms, like, when we go on the night raids, you know, to stomp these terrorists. But it was, we had, like, I'd never met anybody in the New York City Fire Department, but felt that close connection.
Sure.
And, I mean, we wore those patches with pride, and it was good stuff.
I know I saw several photographs of missiles, bombs that were going to be dropped, and they would write names of our guys on the bombs and say, "This one's for Captain Terry Hatton," or "This one's for Sergio Villanueva." And they would take photographs of the bombs before they dropped them.
It's incredible. Hey, Brandon, I'm also wondering, as you kind of asked him about what was it like watching this, knowing that your friends possibly had died. I mean, is this similar to something you might have experienced when there's an IED attack, when you guys are under fire?
I mean, I was really, going over to Afghanistan with SEAL Team 3 Echo Platoon, like, it just still amazes me that there was probably three or four situations where the whole platoon shouldn't have come back from Afghanistan. We were out in Kandahar doing live fire training, sighting in our weapons, and the training area was one of the original Tarnak Farms, it was called. It was in the original video that you saw of Osama bin Laden, the Al-Qaeda camp with the guys doing the monkey bars. It was that, we were at that area, and they knew we were going out there. We'd been out there a few times, and the Taliban were watching us, and they had mined the area. We went out to sight in weapons one day outside of the base at Kandahar, and I remember parking the Humvee, getting out, looking at the rear driver's side tire, and seeing detonation cords sticking out of the tire. And I had parked on an anti-tank mine tied into three anti-personnel mines. Fast forward, you know, a couple weeks later, we're in Bagram at Roberts, what's now known as Roberts Ridge. You know, Neil Roberts fell out of a chopper, and a QRF, quick reaction force element, like, got activated. I was a part of that element with the Danish special ops guys, and we got on Razor 1, and we're sitting on the ramp in Bagram, and then friends of Marty Scovlin and Jack Murphy, they came out. The Rangers were also part of the QRF. They said, "Hey, guys, get off. you know, we're the QRF for these guys. We're gonna go up. So we got off that helicopter. 15 minutes later, the helicopter shot down. Half of the crew got gunned down by enemy fire, or you know, and it was tragic. And I had to listen to that because we got four deployed, and we're 15 minutes away by helicopter, and listening to the radio calls. And those guys were, the Ranger captain would come with the radio and say, look, I got a guy, he's bleeding out, the sun's going down, he's going to die unless we get him out of here. And I remember at the time the officer that was in charge of the Special Operations Tactical Operations Center did not have a special operations background. He was an Air Force pilot, and he was frozen in fear, and I could hear it. He didn't want to let us go in and get these guys, and it was like heartbreaking for us to be there knowing that we're 15 minutes away, wanting to help, like would give our own lives to go in there and get these guys out, and that this son of a bitch back at the talk was too much of a coward to like make a call. He was frozen in fear, and you know, that's something that I'll remember to this day. But those situations, you know, thinking after coming home from Afghanistan and going, wow, like that's, I can't even believe I'm out alive, you know, as well as the rest of the guys. And when you look at, you know, my friends who are no longer here, and the whole thing was an inspiration behind Among Heroes, my next book, is these guys, what would they have gone on to do or be? For instance, a guy that survived that Afghanistan deployment with me is the second Navy SEAL astronaut, Chris Cassidy, mission commander.
Wow.
So you look at like this guy survived. So what are all these other guys that aren't here? What could have they went on to do? And to rob that from them and their family and the humanity is crazy. You know, it's crazy to think about.
All right, so looking at the fire truck, at the back of the fire truck, there's actually something handwritten that says, Jeff, we will never forget you. So I wanted to ask Tim about who Jeff was.
Yeah, Jeff Giordano was the senior man, one of the senior men in Ladder 3. He was the, what we call the chauffeur, driving Ladder 3. So he would sit in the front seat, and then Captain Patty Brown would sit in the shotgun seat. And Jeff was someone that everyone loved, Jeff Giordano. He was a real special guy. He volunteered with the Burn Center. He, you know, did a lot of work with firemen who were burned, kids who were burned. He was just one of those guys that his, like Patty Brown or myself, his whole life was the fire department. And he just happened to, you know, take special notice of the Burn Center. And so he was just like another legendary guy. So you had the legendary guy, Jeff Giordano, driving the legendary Captain Patty Brown. It was a big hit for us to lose those guys.
So wrapping up here from the Soft Rep office in New York City, thanks again to Tim for giving us this great tour of the memorial exhibit. Brandon, if you want to give us some final thoughts on everything you saw and your reaction to it. And by the way, I think it's so cool for the audience to see someone who was there in the action and then you, someone who reacted to it.
Yeah, I mean, it's having that connection to 9/11 and even talking to one of the ladies that is responsible doing all the fact checking for the museum, and just telling her stuff that, wow, I found this poster, propaganda poster in Afghanistan, and having her react and say, wow, we want that, like we want to curate that piece.
Which we couldn't record, by the way. There's certain things that we were off limits to record.
Yeah, but it, you know, it's such a sobering thing. And I remember walking around the corner where they had the model of the Trade Center, and you see the posters up there of the all the movies and an entertainment.
Godzilla, Superman.
And Man on Wire. And in it, what all I immediately thought of was that Michael Moore bullshit that over the movie American Sniper. Because walking out of that, around that corner, and feeling so like somber and just heavy and reflecting on the whole experience, that's how I felt at the end of the movie American Sniper. And so that's why I really, you know, I've kind of changed my opinion looking at people react to the movie that Eastwood made, and it does give you that sobering experience. I mean, here I am in that area where we're listening to the stories, and one story about somebody that you knew as well. I had no connection to these people, but listening to the stories, seeing the pictures, you know, I mean, I was like tearing up in that one area. And then I think that's the way that people are feeling about that movie. And I just mentioned it only because, I mean, I'm tired of talking about it, but it did hit me with seeing all the entertainment posters. And then here's this guy, Michael Moore, who has never taken the time to look at things objectively from the other side. He's just looking through one lens, and to say those harsh comments and not like take one moment to learn about who Chris Kyle is and what it's like to go.
And he admitted he didn't see the movie.
Yeah,
so.
And what it's like to go to war and what it's like to serve. Period. Whether you're a firefighter running up the stairs as people are coming down, and even the people at the museum are who were quoted in that one exhibit that was off limits there on the audio, they said, yeah, I'm going downstairs relieved to get out of this building, looking at these firemen, knowing that most of them are running up to their deaths, and they're going to die. And you know, for a guy like Michael Moore, that and I'm not saying everyone has to serve, but not to take the time to really like get into that other side of things just shows you how naive and what lack of character he has to say those things. And it just shows, you know, it's like we are defined by our actions, and to see the way that he's behaved in the media, initially trying to glom on and draft by saying mean statements about the movie and about my friend Chris, and then try to immediately backpedal when he figured out his own fan base started attacking him because they're saying, no, this is a movie about, this isn't a war movie. This is a movie like about Chris and, you know, his sacrifice. And that's what that museum reminds me of. It's like, that's the sacrifice that everybody made that day. And the people that, you know, the 3,000 people that lost their lives. So that was a heavy, heavy tour. And I mean, I'm blown away that that's been there, and I haven't really,
same here, that I discovered. Yeah,
I think it's like this massive thing that's just hiding in Manhattan, and I'm excited to do the show and put the pictures up because I think it's going to drive people there, even people from my own community that I know will be motivated to see that stuff. Now it's a must see in New York City for me. Like anyone that comes to New York, that's going to be the number one thing I'll recommend seeing. Is you have to go to that museum, and we rush through.
Yeah,
we were 2-3 hours.
You could have been there hours.
And you're going to spend days getting through that stuff, but seeing the, and it's a beautiful place.
Like the amount of architecture that they were able to bring over from that site and put it into a museum is incredible.
Yeah, the design and thoughtfulness that went into the creation of that museum is unbelievable. It's the most significant piece of art and history I've ever seen in my life. Like that's and obviously, you know, we have, I think the world has a real connection to 9/11, anybody that was alive that day. So anyway, yeah, an incredible tour, and the fact that we're connected to the museum now, I'm sharing my friends and some of my personal artifacts from Afghanistan with the museum is pretty cool.
Yeah, and it was an honor to be there. You know, actually, one other thing I wanted to mention as we're wrapping up, you did turn to me at one point in the museum and you were like, I can't believe that there's people who believe that this is a conspiracy. And before we got in the museum, I don't know if you noticed it, there was a guy shouting behind us who was like, it's all lied, and you hear all that. You know, even in the heart of New York City, you see those billboards about Building 7 was, you know, taken down by controlled demolition, and it really, like, makes you think about these people. And it's not like I haven't And I don't know about you, and you can get into it. It's not like I haven't examined all the stuff out there. I mean, I've watched all the conspiracy videos, and they're all taken down by a lot of these architects who shoot down all these conspiracies and debunk them.
Yeah, you know, it's, and I'll be direct and to the point. I was sharing my opinion about Jesse Ventura and the whole truther bullshit. It's just going to that museum. How could you, like, it's just, there's just absolutely no way that 9/11 was a conspiracy. It's just, I mean, it's just in the realm of madness to for somebody to think that. You know, in, is there, like, legitimate things that happen in government to take away our civil liberties? Yeah, absolutely. Sure. And I talked about that. That was another emotion that kind of came to the surface for me is, okay, we've really lost the war when we think about, we let these terrorists affect our freedom, like significantly reduce our privacy and our civil liberties, all in the name, under a very nice name, the Patriot Act.
Yeah.
and these other laws. Like, I didn't go sign up and fight for my country to defend freedom and then see these politicians in Washington D.C. and bureaucrats attempt to kind of like grab onto a little bit more power. That infuriates me, and so that was another emotion that kind of came to the surface. But as well as thinking, wow, I can't believe people actually are drinking the Kool-Aid, and there's no way they probably, I would be willing to bet, have seen that museum, or else they would be eating their words.
They might, but I just feel like the conspiracy theorists, they hold on to conspiracy theory matter what. That's who they are. They want to believe nothing could possibly be as it seems. Nothing can possibly be the official story.
And they won't look at things objectively, and that's why Michael Moore is in the category of an extremist, and that's somebody that will never change their mind, and they can't get off the subject. I think that's the quote that Churchill made about an extremist.
Like,
he just won't change... will never change his mind, no matter how convincing, you know, the argument. Won't listen to anything and can't change the damn subject.
You know what else I was thinking about wrapping this up is that, you know, that is such a perfect memorial to everything that went down. It's obviously tragic. They even have tissues outside some of the exhibits because a lot of people will not be leaving there with a dry eye. But it made me think of just a couple of years ago when right around that area there was the controversy about building that Islamic, you know, center. And I remember just the emotions it invoked in people. And I think it just angered people that right around that area, that was going to be built there. And, you know, some were calling it a victory mosque. And it goes back to, you know, hearing Tim's reaction saying, you know, this was radical Islam. We have to call it what it is. And the fact that people would think that would be an appropriate thing to build in that vicinity, I get why people were pissed off.
Yeah, it was one question I wanted to ask because I'm just not sure of the events surrounding that mosque. Like it seems like you know, especially after talking to Tim and him talking about this army captain friend of his who's a Muslim and about, you know, living in harmony with the different religions and beliefs, which is very, you know, aligned with what I believe as
same
well.
Same here, yeah. And Jack as well. We talk about it all the time.
Yeah, and so I don't understand, like, and I want to dig into a little bit more, Tim, there must have been some antagonism around the people that wanted to do the mosque at Ground Zero. I don't think it was a, you know, like, let's all hold hands and get along. It seems to me like it was a very antagonistic play, and that's what pissed people off about the mosque. Like, that's my read on it up till now.
And the guy who was behind it, because I've learned a little bit more about him, was, you know, he was a slumlord. That was his history.
Yeah, and I think that's the problem with it. If it had been done, and it's a shame, because I think had it been done in earnest and like true earnest fashion, I think people would have been open to it. And what a great symbol to kind of like show that, you know, look, we can all live in this world peacefully and in harmony, regardless of your race, religion, you know, beliefs.
Sure.
And so it was a shame that this slumlord dude
yeah,
you know, fucked that up for everybody.
I agree. And it was actually interesting. I said to you at one point during the museum, they were showing a speech of George Bush's after the event. And he said very much the same type of thing, that this is not on an entire religion, that that what we're launching is against the radicals. And I think people often forget that George Bush made those type of speeches and it all gets pegged on Obama, even though watching it was kind of a very similar type of speech, very similar ideal of what we believe in as America. So
yeah, no, I agree.
One last thing, actually, as I was walking through that I just thought of. You know, I wasn't like writing down what I wanted to speak about, but I think this is possibly a good way to wrap it. Watching those videos of al-Zawahiri and Osama saying that we're planning this attack, we're going to launch this attack, and us doing nothing, a lot of people probably reflect on what's going on now. And ISIS is saying flat out, this is the caliphate we want. With this caliphate, we want to get rid of all Westerners, basically. We want to get rid of America. You know, we want to destroy Israel. And if we're going to take these threats seriously, it's very much the exact same type of dialogue that al-Qaeda was bringing.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, we're seeing this, the emergence of, you know, that this radical Islamic movement stronger than ever, stronger before 9/11. And it's just sad that we don't have, you know, a few world leaders, especially in this country, because we should be leading from the front to really take charge. And look at what's happening with these Japanese journalists and ISIS. Like, they're going after anyone who doesn't believe in their way of life and trying to promote change through violence. And it's time for the free world to really, and it's crushing to think about. We don't have a leader like a Churchill, you know what I mean? Like a Reagan, a John F. Kennedy, to go stand up and really like craft this strong narrative to bring everyone together to stomp this out in a very smart fashion. Because everything we've done up to date is just, it's stoked the fire of radicalism into this bonfire, and it's getting out of control. You look at ISIS. And it's like, okay, what do we have to do? And we write about it in the ISIS solution, the ebook that that me and the guys did, which is a great book. I'd encourage anyone to read that book. You know, we talk about, you know, really approaching this radical Islamic problem in an entirely different fashion. And it really is, you know, I think and a leader is going to emerge. We need it in this country bad. Like, there's no greater time where we need some true leadership in this country to kind of rein in and lead the rest of the world. Like, it's just how Churchill, you look at Churchill and how powerful his speeches were to move people to action. And that's what we need. We need to stomp out this Islamic threat once and for all. Make it put that global social pressure on that extremist view and make it out of fashion. Like, we need to just stomp it out once and for all. Because what we're doing now is just feeding it. I mean, recruiting is at an all-time high. And then it's, you know, now me spending so much time in New York City, it's a major concern for me. Like, I literally chose a home office in an area where I knew that I would limit my peak hour subway travel, because it's only a matter of time for these shitbags are going to hit us again. And so this stuff I think about, but it's time we end it once and for all, because we're in a new world. And you look at people that try and put their head in the sand, look what happened in Paris, look what's happening in the Middle East, around the rest of the world, Boko Haram in Africa. It's time that we've got to do something about this.
Yeah. Thanks again to everybody for listening. Thanks once again to Tim for giving us this tour. We greatly appreciate it. We hope that this was a good reflection of all of you on the whole event, and those who experienced 9/11 and lost people in 9/11, or even the young listeners who really didn't experience it firsthand. Hopefully we did a good job of that for you. We'll be back next week, I'm sure, with something a little bit more uplifting as we try to switch it up. But this was a very special podcast for us, and we appreciate it. Thanks.
You've been listening to Surf Rep Radio. New episodes up every Wednesday and Friday. Follow the show on Instagram and Twitter @SurfRep Radio.